Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the In The Bin Rugby Pod, brought to you by The Last Word on rugby.com. And what an amazing weekend of rugby it was this weekend. Quins won away, Gloucester didn't. Falcons and Saris played away, but no one was there to watch them, unfortunately. And the Saints continue to rise, and Worcester and Irish, well, they continue to fall. So I'm your host, Andy Wenborn, and as always, I'm with my partner in crime, Paddy.
Good evening.
And well, should we start with that debacle in the USA?
Yeah, let's start there, so then we can say happy things when we're done. Just seemed a bit of a waste of time to me, to be honest. I'm not entirely sure why they seem so intent on cracking America, so to speak. You know, I think I've heard a lot of stuff about growing the game banded around, but judging by the empty stands, there doesn't seem to be a particularly big appetite for it. And I don't know whose fault that is, whether it is just a complete waste of time or whether it was kind of promoted and marketed just not quite right, you know, in the build up to it. But it wasn't very nice to look at for any Premiership game, looking at all those empty seats, was it?
Yeah, like you say, I mean, it's been a while since the actual game, and it wasn't, you know, an inspiring game anyway. But I don't see why they took it to Philadelphia. I've never heard of Philadelphia being a hotbed of rugby over there. And it showed, you know, if you're going to take a team, you know, like we said last time, you take Irish probably to Boston on St. Patrick's Day, and that's probably the only time I would imagine you could possibly get a big crowd. It's college football season, it's NFL season, and I just don't get the growing the game. If you want to grow the game, the markets currently are your Eastern Europe, Russia, Romania, Georgia. You know, that's where you want to go.
Yeah, that would make a lot more sense, and that's why, you know, I probably sound not too pleased with the whole affair, because I'm all for growing the game and getting rugby out there. But as you say, that there seem to be some really obvious choices if you're going to do that make a lot more sense. And yeah, there, you know, a lot of places in Eastern Europe where they could go. There are probably even some a little bit further afield. But the States, it almost just seems like there's, you know, a guy in a suit who's thought, right, yeah, America, great idea. Let's go there. And then I just don't know how much thought has actually gone into it. And particularly Philadelphia, you know, why? I'm not saying that it's just a complete failure and it's something that could never work, but it just seems that all of the thinking behind where and when and what to do in the build up hasn't been thought through even close to good enough. Because yeah, it just seems like the timing was wrong, the location was wrong. And, you know, maybe there are some other options to try and do it, but it just seems like that wasn't it.
Well, what the suits have seen is dollars, and they see dollars from a TV deal. That the TV money in America is obviously far greater than the other markets, so they might not even be that bothered by the empty stands. They might look at it as a success if NBC got a load of viewers, because then they're going to be able to charge more money for a TV deal, and that's where the money is these days. The money isn't in getting 20,000 fans into Welford Road or 25 into the Rico. It's selling the rights to BT Sport for X amount of millions of pounds, which is what they did last time. And that's where you can suddenly have Owen Farrell on 750 grand a year, reportedly. And that's where they're generating the income from. So I'm not sure they're going to be too fussed it was empty, if I'm honest.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know what the viewing figures are. I'd like to see them. But I just think that there's usually not that big a disparity. You know, if it's a popular sport that's going to pull in viewing figures, you would have thought more people would have made an effort to go to the game, because it wasn't just like there were a few empty seats. It was embarrassing. And no matter what size you are as a TV network, whether it is NBC or someone like that, it doesn't look good showing sports when that's what the stadium looks like. That isn't a good look for any sports channel. So yeah, to say, I don't know what the viewing figures are TV-wise. I'd be interested to see them, but I wouldn't expect them to be anything too impressive.
No, and I mean, if a game of rugby had broken out at any point, they might have got away with it. But I mean, I think the less said about the game, the better. I mean, Wild scored that first try, very nice American guy scoring in America. And I don't know how teams haven't cottoned on to this move from Saris yet. Wrap around, they get the fullback coming in and the extra winger coming in to make the overlap. It's almost copied off Leinster with Johnny Sexton. And the open wingers free to run down the wing and score. I mean, they use it a lot, and teams have used it for ages, and it was poor. I mean, because Newcastle's defence, other than that, was exceptional all night. They were really, really good. But that's just basic.
I was actually quite impressed with Newcastle again. I think their defence was very impressive, and a couple of times I got quite annoyed with them because they seem to have done a lot of good defending, in their own 22, and then given away a silly penalty when actually they were doing absolutely fine as they were. But handling errors were the order of the day. From what I understand, it was incredibly humid out there, and it made the ball a bit of a nightmare to keep hold of. But then this again feeds back into the bloody timing. You know what the weather's going to be like in areas of the States at certain times of the year. Surely there could have been better scheduling involved. But before I go off on that again, yeah, anyway, the game just wasn't a great spectacle. And I think they'll both be quite happy to get back over here.
Yeah, it was the standard slow strangle by Saracens. Just strangle and strangle and strangle the life out of the team, kick your points, and then you win the game. And yeah, I think we could don't really need to say much more about that game, really.
No, let's move on.
So it's been a long time since these games, so I'm just going to move straight on to my favourite game of the weekend, and we'll talk about Wasps Quins.
Absolutely my favourite as well.
I mean, you forget that they're old local rivals, and actually Wasps used to be based sort of near Acton, which isn't too far from Twickenham, just north of the river in London, and they really didn't like it. You got that old sort of spicy derby feel to it, and actually it was nice to see Quins have a bit of niggle, have a bit of nasty, because usually they're not known for that, and they really got under Wasps' skin.
Yeah, I think it was. I know some people aren't happy with all of the business going on, but I think it was really clever by Quins, and it's exactly the kind of performance that a lot of people have been pulling for a team like Quins or Gloucester to do. And look at the record Wasps have at the Rico. It was 20 games, was it? I think on the nose, unbeaten there. And if you just go there, turn up, an expansive. Kind of, they've got that expansive attacking mentality, Quins. If you just turn up to the Rico, then chances are you're going to lose. And they thought, actually, no, do you know what? We're going to get absolutely stuck into this. We're going to get under their skin. We're going to wind them up. We're going to get a bit of niggle involved. And I just think it's really clever. You know, why wouldn't you? And it's dispelled a lot of the stuff about Quins being, you know, weak or poor or not travelling very well, because that is exactly the type of gritty performance you want when you go away from home. And I was really impressed. It wasn't, you know, the tri-fest that either of us were hoping for or expecting, but I didn't find it any less absorbing or exciting to watch. It was just a different type of excitement than I was expecting.
It was the tackles, it was the hits, it was the ferocity at the breakdown was something that it was almost test match level sort of breakdown hitting. And I think that's where Wasps got let down a little bit by losing both of their flankers in the first 60 minutes. It meant that they had to bring Haskell on from his comeback really early. I mean, I know he got a 10-minute rest, but he still had to play 60 minutes on return. Ashley Johnson came on early, which meant they couldn't take their hooker off. So I think it did mean when they were chasing the game at the end and you'd normally try and empty your bench, it was quite tricky for them to add some impetus in the forwards. And also, we'll get on to Quins players playing exceptionally well, and a lot of them, I think, putting their hand up towards Eddie Jones. I've been disappointed by Joe Launchbury so far this season. For a man who was talked up massively for missing the Lions and, he's the player that missed out, he hasn't set the world alight like some of the players have so far at the start of the season.
No, it is a strange one because I know we had so many conversations about Lions selection, and I think on the whole, it was probably one of the happiest I've been looking at a Lions squad. But it did seem like a glaring omission to leave out Launchbury. And I think it's fair to say the universal consensus was if there was one guy unlucky not to be on the plane, it was him. And you would maybe expect that even with that disappointment still burning, that he would hit the ground running and would be, you know, just going at it like a madman at the start of the season. But he really, you know, the standout second rows, we're talking more about Courtney Laws at the moment than Launchbury. And it is a little bit disappointing. Obviously, there's plenty of time for him to come back into it, but he doesn't quite seem to have that punch or authority that he was carrying towards the end of last season.
Yeah, and when you compared him with Horwell on the other side, I mean, we said at the start of the year that Horwell and Robshaw in that sort of pack needed to step up and make themselves sort of heard and really lead from the front. And I think Horwell was exceptionally, definitely outplayed Launchbury for me. I think moving Clifford to flanker worked exceptionally well. They brought in the new number 8. He looked really, really good. It meant Ward got to hooker, much better at hooker. And it just gave their pack a lot more balance to then get the ball out to the wonder kid, to the number 10, yeah. Marcus Smith, who I mean, and I can't remember what I said last time. At 18, I was definitely not winning Man of the Match in Aviva Premiership games.
No, he's looking really good, and it looks like rapid progression as well. I know a lot of people thought it might be too soon to lob him into the first game. But the thing is, when you've got players with that much talent, you don't really know unless you give them a chance. But and he's probably caught a break again with Kater Akilis getting that, you know, that nasty injury. If he hadn't got that, then we could be looking at Smith being benched for the last two games and coming on. But he's been given the opportunity, and there were so many impressive aspects of his game. And it's not just the exciting flash stuff. Towards the end of the game, you know, he put that kick in behind, which Wade had to take out for a line out. And that was just brilliant control of the situation, a tense game away against an incredibly good side. And you can see him, even if he's running up towards the line out, he's running his mouth, he's shouting at players, he's giving it some. And I think all of those signs bode incredibly well to show that, you know, he's progressing so quickly, and he's going to be some player. And I think we're already starting to see why so many people are excited, but it is good to see him.
Yeah, and I think the other one on the Quinn side that Eddie Jones would have been pleased with was Marlon Yard. Now, wing is a tough position to get into in the England squad. I mean, you look at Rocco Degun, he can't get in. That's the best I've seen Marlon Yard play, because I am not his biggest fan. I never really understood why he was an England shirt to start with most of the time. But I thought he had a very, very good game, and he's going to be knocking on the door soon.
Yeah, I certainly think he needs to do it more often. I remember when he was first playing for Irish, and I thought, you know, you could see that he could potentially get an England call-up. And I thought his career would have moved on at a faster pace than it has. And he does tend to have games where he's good and games where he's not. You know, I don't want to knock him again, because it was an incredibly impressive performance from him. And, you know, I think a couple more like that, then he's going to be hard to ignore. But I would like to see him do it for the next few games and consistently do it. And then I think it's fair to say that, you know, he can be knocking on the door.
And I think the last one on this is it's got to clear up a bit of news. Cipriani apparently out for close to 3 months with a knee injury, which is gutting for Wasps. I mean, because Gopeth isn't hopefully going to be fit this weekend, but he wasn't fit last weekend. And I think Cipriani not being there showed, with 2 minutes to go, he went down injured, and Wasps needed to get themselves into position for either a drop goal or to try and win the game. And they just lost all composure. They had some silly offloads and a stupid knock-on, and the game's over. Because he's on the floor not controlling things. And like you say, with Smith barking at everybody on the Quinn side, that's exactly what Cipriani's done for years at Wasps.
I think it is also not great timing, because Wasps are quite lucky in that aspect. Usually they can have Cipriani or Gopeth, but Gopeth was rested for the game. And when you've got both of them not able to do it, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a concern for Wasps. It was just bad timing, because they do have completely adequate backup and someone else to do that. Is sometimes you can't plan for having Gopeth in the stands and then Cipriani going down as well. It definitely showed, but I don't think it's anything that's necessarily a big concern.
No, right. Well, I think we'll move on from Wasps Quins. And
are we going to move on without talking about the big one?
The big one?
Haskell and Marla.
Well, I was going to come to that later, because I've got a whole rant prepared on cynical play in rugby and my sort of frustrations with consistency with refereeing. But we can go into that now if you like. I'm more than willing to rant.
Go on, let's do it. Let's get stuck in and treat ourselves.
Right. So first of all, players buying penalties is annoying me. We had Fotolii do it last week, and this week it happened. The Sarri scrum half did it. He passed and just hit a lazy runner coming back. He could have easily missed him, and they got a penalty. And I didn't see Scout Brits complaining this week. When we get onto the Tigers Gloucester game, Young's first try was an excellent break from a tap penalty. But if you watch that, Ellis Gensch has held the guy down over the ball so badly. He's got hold of his shirt by the collar and he's holding him down, and the ref's done him for lying on the ball. It is so beautifully done. But the ref should be spotting that. You can see he's got a fistful of his shirt and he's holding him on top of the ball, but the ref's giving it anyway. And then you got Marla. All right, Haskell shouldn't have reacted like he did. There's no excuse for grabbing a player around the neck. But a scrum cap is there. He wears it for protection. He might have reasons for doing it. He might have concussion history. Whatever reason he wants to wear a scrum cap, you can't use it to pull someone down and pull them out of the way. It's like pulling hair in football. It's just cheap, and I'm not having it. And I can't remember who I was listening to, but someone was saying they should have a penalty like they do in the NFL for taunting, where actually the person who decides to be an idiot and try and gain an advantage by winding someone up is penalised more. And I think that really should, they should be looking at something like that in rugby, unsportsmanlike conduct. You know, when people hold people in at rucks and they grab their foot and then someone kicks out at them and it's the person who kicks out that gets sin-binned, just winds me up something rotten.
Yeah, I think that there are really irritating times in games, and I get more wound up by things like the scrum halves just tanking a ball at somebody's ankles that's offside to win a penalty and that kind of stuff. But until we have it in, I know a lot of people think that Marler should have gone off. I don't have a problem with it. I don't think Marler should have gone off, and I think Haskell should have. And it would have been different if he'd have been yanking his scrum cap to pull him down. But he was just winding him up. It was just a little pull. There wasn't anything that was dangerous in terms of the play. And if Haskell's going to be idiotic enough because he's got a short fuse to go for him, and he went for him twice, and everyone, you know what to expect from Marler. You know, he's got a history of winding people up. And rugby is a game where you're always going to have niggle in it. And I don't mind niggle at all. And if he can't cope with Marler doing that and squirting a bit of water on him, how would you feel about taking him away into a, say, on an away series to New Zealand if it was in the balance and a real pressure cooker? Everyone will be at it. All of those players will be winding him up. And because there isn't anything to do with unsportsmanlike conduct, and it's going to be quite a difficult law to enforce anyway, I just think that Haskell was just a moron, and I think he was rightly sin-binned. And I also absolutely don't think that Marler should have gone. I think it's nonsense.
No, the everyone knows he's like that excuse I hate, right? So that means that if someone who's not like Marler does it, they're going to get sin-binned because it's out of character, not having that. It's the same as in football when someone gets sent off. They go, he's not that sort of player. Well, he is that sort of player because he just stands
on it. I'm not saying that at all. And I hate that he's not that sort of player because he's done it and he is. All I'm saying for Marler is that Haskell should be prepared for him to do it. I'm not saying that the treatment for Marler should be any different. I'm just saying that Haskell, I know he's, you know, he's not exactly a clever player either, the way he gives away penalties. You know, he doesn't seem like the brightest spark. But you should know going into a game that potentially someone like Joe Marler is going to wind you up. Now, as I said, I'm not saying if someone else did it, they should get a different punishment or be punished. I'm just saying Haskell, he should be prepared. And as soon as you see Marler doing that, you should just think of, you know, God's sake, it's Joe Marler trying to wind me up. And he should know it's coming and not do it. I'm not saying it should be different punishments for different players. But Haskell should know. You should, like, you know, Joe Marler's not a subtle man either, is he? So I just think that makes it even worse, in my opinion, that he fell for it.
Well, for me, they either both go or neither go. And I think the RFU or the Premiership...
Why does Marler go, though? What has he done that actually deserves a sin bin?
Well, pulling his... You've grabbed something on a player and pulled it. If I grabbed someone's hair and pulled it, I'd get sin binned.
It wasn't like he's pulled it, as I said, in a dangerous way. He's literally just given it a little tickle just to wind him up. There's nothing dangerous about it.
Then you're getting into semantics about stuff. And I think, and the RFU or the EV Premiership agree, because they've given Marler a sort of a yellow card.
Which is nonsense post-haste. Well. Complete nonsense. And that is a dangerous precedent to start setting. And they've only done it because we've had people crying about it. And I just think people are overreacting to it. I think there's only one guy in the wrong there, and it's Haskell. That's wound me up, that he's now got this retrospective kind of yellow card. I think it's ridiculous.
But what it does is it sets the precedent for people to realise that they just get on with the game. Don't start grabbing people. Unless a fight's breaking out and you've got to take someone away, leave him.
There is an argument, though, to say that that is part of the game, and it always has been.
But you can't do it in the... It's professional now. This isn't the 1970s when people got stamped on, or even the 90s. And it's not like I play down, you know, at local club level where there's no active linesman, there's no cameras, there's no 20,000 people in the stand. And if someone wants to give you a cheap shot, they give you a cheap shot. This is televised on, you know, big bucks going on, and they want to clean it up to get it out. And, you know, it's a marketable product now. It's all about getting the product out. And having people do that doesn't look good, and they're just going to clamp down on it.
Yeah, but who didn't enjoy watching it?
I'm not saying we didn't enjoy watching it. I'm saying what they're trying to do is not have little kids seeing it. And that's always the argument, is role model this, role model that. You know, they say it in football. You know,
it's boring, though, isn't it?
It is boring, and we like characters. But I don't like people winding people up and then not being able to take it. So they either both go or neither go for me, and then I think everything's fine.
Well, I suppose we'll agree to disagree. But one thing as well is I was getting sick to death of hearing the commentators compliment the referee because I thought he was awful. And what particularly was grating on me was as the game wore on and the second half, there was more niggle there and there were players chatting back at him. And he would start giving penalties. And I think Sinclair did it and he marched Quinn's back 10 metres. And it was Lawrence, wasn't it? And Ugo was, I think, in the commentary box. And they're all saying, oh, look at that, referee's not taking it. Idiots brought it on himself. Now, I know Haskell was frustrated, but the way he spoke to the ref when he binned him, he just let him do it. And there was no way that someone like Nigel Owens or Wayne Barnes would have accepted that for a second. And then all of the players have seen that Haskell's spoken to him like that and he hasn't done anything. And so I think he's brought the whole thing on himself. And there's no point praising him for then cracking down on it because he's let the situation escalate to the point where he's having to do it. And I just think that he came across as a really weak referee in that game. And when you compare it to some of the other refs you've got knocking around, whether you like them as refs or not, you know for damn sure that, as I said, people particularly like Wayne Barnes and Nigel Owens would not have been having that nonsense for a second.
It was only, I think, his seventh or eighth Premiership game, so he will learn. And I imagine he's going to have he's probably had a review already. That game was on Sunday, wasn't it? He's probably sat in front of a panel who have given him not a dressing down, but they've probably explained to him you need to be a bit tougher. So what you'll see next time is that he'll probably change his ways and he'll probably be extra tough and a bit more forceful and it'll work it out. It's only seven games in. You're not looking at a player to be perfect after seven games. So I'm going to give the ref slight leeway on that one.
It's not an easy gig at all. And I don't expect referees to be perfect all the time. I think the reason it's wound me up so much is that the commentators seem to be falling over themselves to praise it. When I just thought, well, actually, I think you're missing the point that the only reason it's got to this stage is because he didn't deal with it in the first place. So let's not start turning it into something it isn't. I just think that he brought it on himself.
Now, this leads me nicely into my other ranting point of the day. Consistency of refereeing is shocking. The example I've got from this weekend is deliberate knock-ons.
Yeah.
So you've got one in the Saris Falcons game. Gonova knocked it on. Now, Gonova's known for going for interceptions. So whether it was absolutely deliberate or whether he thought he could catch it, I don't know. But he got yellow card and a penalty try. Then there was one in the Quinns Wasps game where Cipriani went for it. And I think Jamie Roberts from 7 yards, if he catches that ball, is probably going to score. But it's just a yellow card, no penalty try. And then there was one in the Tigers Leicester game where it was a deliberate knock-on. And I know he was playing advantage for another penalty, but if it goes to the winger, there's cover coming over, so penalty try is debatable, but there wasn't even a card.
I don't know how he got away with a yellow in that one, without a yellow.
And then to add to that, I watched Argentina-Australia and there was what I thought was a definite deliberate knock-on and the ref just gave it as a normal knock-on. And this consistency is, there needs to be something because they all looked very similar to me and there was just four completely different outcomes.
Well, it drives you up the wall, doesn't it? Consistency in refereeing. But there does come a point when I end up just thinking, well, what on earth are we going to do about it? Because as you pointed out, it's not like these were all quite different. And so the referees interpreted it in a different way. A lot of them all look the bloody same. And that's why when, as a viewer, you're watching them thinking, well, that looked the same. So why are we getting different outcomes? And I don't know how you try and get that out of the game. In terms of referees, I think sometimes they can be dealt with harshly. And I think the one that would always be particularly difficult is the where do you draw the line with if he didn't knock it on, I think it was going to be a try, penalty try. I think that would cause a lot of debate. But as far as giving a yellow card goes, it seems to be fairly straightforward. And the Gloucester guy, I don't know who it was that did it, but you saw him straight away, hands straight to his head. He knew what he'd done. He was expecting to go off and somehow completely got away with it.
It's ridiculous. And on a similar vein, there was a penalty try for London Irish for a driving Moore collapse and the Sale lad got a yellow card. In the Quinns Wasps game, driving Moore going to the line, Sinclair has been told not to move or to get out, and he changes his bind and he drops it. He gets yellow carded, no penalty try. And then in the Tigers Gloucester game, Tigers are marching towards the line and it gets brought down. Ref does absolutely nothing. Luckily, Youngs nips blinds and scores. But again, there just seems to be a lack of clarity in the thinking of, if it's driving towards the line, they're within 5 metres and he brings it down, is it yellow and penalty try? Is it just a yellow? There's got to be some sort of, again, consistency in the thinking between the referees.
Yeah, I don't think it'll ever happen, but I've always been a big fan of the idea of referees explaining a few of their decisions, you know, not necessarily straight after the game, but if there was some kind of, you know, because we know that they review the games themselves and they review their performances. What I'd really like is then on a Monday or some, you know, a Tuesday, something like that, for whoever it is, you know, if they had a kind of a spokesperson that they appointed, probably Wayne Barnes, let's face it, to come out and say, look, these were some of the key decisions that there seem to have been some controversial comments about, or people are unsure why it's different to other decisions in different games over the weekend. And this is what the ref's been thinking. And that's not to say we need to put the refs on trial and make them feel uncomfortable, but everyone would just feel so much better if sometimes refs either explained why it was different in their eyes, or just said, actually, I didn't see that, or I interpreted differently because I'd missed something in the play. And so it was a mistake. And when people say that, no one is going to start shooting them. You know, no one's going to be unhappy. And so I just think that there's, you know, there's a lot of reasons, and it'd be so good if we could have something like that. But I just don't think it will happen. But I think it would solve a lot of problems, even if it didn't change some of the decisions, if people could just understand what the thinking behind it was.
Yes, it's the same argument that's been going on in football for a long time, isn't it? Can the referee not come out after the game and talk to the press just like the managers do? But they say they're a highly protected species, and I don't think it's going to happen. Right, so if we move away from ranting for a second, now there's four of the games that played this weekend, and I don't think we've got time to go through them all in exceptional detail. But Saints win at Bath, Saints victory at home against Bath, definitely a good marker for them, having beaten Tigers, to then actually up the performance for a second week in a row. And their forwards took on the Bath pack, who had bullied Saracens and Leicester so far, and actually bullied them back.
Yeah, it was really impressive. So we'll get some praise for Saints this week without any caveats at all. Just be praised because they were hugely impressive. It's almost hard to believe how good they've been, given how bad they were in the first game. And as we've discussed, it wasn't just that first game in isolation. It's off the back of a poor season where there seems to be all sorts of uncertainty behind the scenes and around management. And to turn that around and put in those two big performances against Leicester and Bath, and particularly the manner of the Bath game, as you say, with the forwards were so good. And even some of the backs, the way they were getting stuck in there. I thought Burrell had one of the best games I've seen him have in a long time. And it was hugely, hugely impressive. You know, we'll see if they can do it away from Franklin's Gardens. But even regardless of that at the moment, I think they have to have a huge amount of credit to turn around the performances in the manner they've done after that first week stinker.
Yeah, and I quite want to see more of Collins on the wing. He looks like he could be a real prospect. I think he's only 21, 22, and he's just got acceleration, almost like Jason Robertson had, where he looks like he's not going, and all of a sudden he's at top speed very, very quickly, and he's causing a lot of problems for defences.
Yeah, he looks an absolute nightmare to play against. And I think that's what the first thing you look for in a winger is how dangerous are they. But he has been one of the standout wingers of the Premiership season so far. And it'll be really interesting to see how he gets on. I think it will certainly be interesting to see how he stands up when he starts getting tested defensively as well. Because as we know, with people like Wade and Rocco Degouni, that is, if he has any kind of international aspirations, that's going to be something that will be crucial for him in terms of breaking in. But just to take him as he is at the moment, he looks electric. And I've been quite pleased, actually, with the form of 3, 4, 5 wingers in the Premiership so far, because there's some of them, you just give them a sniff and they've looked electric.
Well, things are looking good for England in the autumn. Perhaps with the only other talking point in this game is Underhill coming in to play 7 for England. Now, I didn't get to see the game, but I've watched the highlights. I've read all the reports. Wasn't he brilliant? 23 tackles, smashed anything that moves. You know, he's an angry man and he hits people back on the gain line. But then I did see some nice sort of evaluation pieces talking about whether or not he fits into a back row perfectly, because not all he does is tackle, but he doesn't appear to sort of slow the ball down as much. And some Bath fans were saying they missed that against Northampton, when the Saints forwards got good ball, got going forward, got behind the gain line. Lowe slows the ball down. He's obviously a bit older, he's got a bit more of the sort of cute breakdown skills, whereas Underhill wasn't bringing that to the game. And perhaps they need him to play at 6 with Lowe at 7, and that would complement the balance a bit better.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. And I do think Bath missed Lowe. It's something that I don't think has been spoken about enough, because people have got quite wrapped up with Underhill's performance. And I did watch the game, and it was brilliant. You know, he was just non-stop. But you do need to have more of that in your game. I think, you know, he is a really young guy. And so these are things that as a back row forward, you will learn and you will pick up. But yeah, I think people just need to not get too carried away. I think, 23 tackles in about 65 minutes, I think he did. That is ridiculous. And it was a brilliant performance. He certainly needs to add more to his game before you could understand the level of excitement some people are having. But there's huge potential there, and it's a great basis. But I also think, you know, it's almost the same thing. It's just because he's young and he's having these kind of notable performances tackling. But, you know, what's the difference then between Robshaw a couple of years ago when he was getting criticised for not offering enough in the back row for England? You know, he was, you know, playing at six or seven, and you know that he would have lots of carries, but he would also just tackle non-stop, and he will have a huge number of tackles by the end of the game. So just because it's someone different and young, I don't think people should start shifting the perception. But he definitely has potential to add more to his game, and then we can maybe start talking about it.
I think also if he adds his ability to be a line out jumper, that'd help, because if he's only going to be a seven, and he's not sort of like a Laws or a Toji when you take him at six or a Tom Wood. He's not your sort of standard jumper. And so if you have him in there and say Billy for England, that means you really need your number six to be a jumper in the line out. And it's all about finding that balance. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how Eddie Jones plays it with Underhill and how he uses him in the future.
That might work though, because, you know, it just depends, as you say, it's all about the balance of the back row and what Eddie decides to do with it. But how many times have we seen Laws played at six now and Itoje? So could that be something that he would look at to say, if he was going to play someone like Underhill at seven and have Billy at eight, well, we are going to need someone. He could have, say, Itoje and Cruz in the second row and then Laws at six.
Yeah, I mean, the options for England at the moment, and like you say, that's just the back row. We've talked a lot about wingers as well. I think Eddie Jones has got a not enviable task trying to whittle down a squad and then a starting 15, and he's going to be hard pushed with the form of some of the players so far this season.
Yeah, he really is. It's one of those things. It's an enviable task, but I think there'd be a few international coaches that wouldn't mind being in the situation. But it sometimes makes it more difficult, because you're open to a lot of criticism when you have that many options, because all you do is make the wrong choice on one or two, or what people think is the wrong choice. And then, yeah, people start crucifying you. But Eddie Jones is in a serious amount of credit, isn't he? So I don't think he's not the kind of bloke that looks like he really gives a toss.
Very true. Right. So moving on, we've got three games left. I don't think we can get, and I say, we're not going to go too much depth in all of them. I do want to say, I thought Irish would be a bit closer to Sale. And I think that the fact that Sale sort of strolled away with it quite easily and have sort of broke through Irish's defence a bit easier than I thought they would, is worrying for Irish, and I thought they were, after that first game of the season, they might have been putting up more of a fight in a battle of two teams that we think are going to be in the bottom two or three.
Yeah, it was certainly disappointing how quickly Sale went ahead. I think it's almost, there's some mitigation for it in the fact that we were saying previously what a good home record Sale have. And the fact that they lost a game against Newcastle, a particular game that they will feel they should have won, Irish were always going to feel that, and I think Sale were going to come out firing in this game. And when you're not prepared as you should be defensively, like Irish seem like they weren't at times, then that's really going to show on the scoreboard. It's certainly not an impressive performance by Irish's part. There's things that they're going to have to sort out. But at the same time, I think there are, as I said, some mitigating circumstances around Sale and how they played. But Irish do need to start picking it up. But, you know, they've got their first home game next weekend after, you know, having their first one at Twickenham. And, you know, we've said that it's probably not going to be the away form that decides Irish's season. And we just got to hope that Irish can have a similar sort of reaction to losing to Sale that Sale did losing to Falcons.
Yeah, the only thing I want to add to that is that Sale changed their hooker and won 20 out of 21 of their lineouts. So I think that guy's got the job for next week after the week before. The less said about Blair Cowan sending off, the better. What an absolute moron.
Tool. Just a complete tool for doing that.
Just short arm someone on a... I mean, it's not even subtle. And anyway, you're going to hear more about him later. He's in our new feature.
okay.
Right. So the only ones we haven't spoken about are Tigers Gloucester, although we have touched on that. And Tigers, good first half performance, bad second half performance. Gloucester, bad first half performance, good second half performance. I don't think it was the most enthralling of games, really.
It wasn't. I didn't exactly sit on the edge of my seat watching it. I was starting to think that this was going to be a turning point for Leicester, because the way they came out, everything was just played at a much higher tempo and pace than the previous couple of games. And I don't just mean in terms of ball carrying and defending, but you know, also the fact that they injected a couple of tap and goes for penalties, and it seemed to be it was a real conscious decision by them to, at home, sloppy start to the season, that they were going to inject some real pace to try and get themselves going, and it really worked at first. But I almost think it's more of a worry now that how much they fell away in the second half. And we know that Gloucester aren't the best team away from home, but they really came back into it, and they had some opportunities to actually make that a bit of a horrible day for Leicester in the end. And I think Tigers are indebted to the fact that Gloucester made a few too many errors and weren't able to take the opportunities. But just as I was thinking Tigers are looking like they were turning a corner, I'm now not entirely convinced that much has changed.
Yeah, I think it's a big few weeks for Tigers with the games running into the European fixtures. Matt O'Connor really needs to get them into some form. Otherwise, I think those European games could start to go very, very badly for them quite quickly against some of the big teams.
Yeah, I wonder if they will just think that they need to focus on one or the other, and they just think that actually they need to get themselves out of hole in the league and almost give up on Europe.
Welford Road will not stand for that.
Well, that's it. It's the last side that you would potentially expect to do that, but might be some interesting team selections coming up. We'll have to keep an eye out.
Yeah, and finally, Worcester-Exeter and just poor Worcester, really, having played not too badly last week against Wasps, a bit unlucky to lose by the scoreline they did. They run into Exeter, who were just efficient. I don't think it was the most exceptional of Exeter performances, but that they do what they do very well. And in Sam Simmons, they found an absolute diamond at number eight. And actually, I think with the form Nathan Hughes has had at the start of this season, again, talking about England, he is a more like-for-like replacement for Billy than Nathan Hughes is. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him called into the sort of wider training squad for Eddie Jones to have a nice look at him. And the only other talking point from that game is how the only word I've written down for it is naughty. Slade's chip through was for Woodburn's try. Just looking the wrong way, outside of the boot, over the top, weighted to perfection. It was just sexy, sexy rugby.
It was certainly one of the most classy plays of the weekend. And Slade's always had that in him. It's great to see him doing it. And you do feel a little bit sorry for Worcester. There is just a gulf, isn't there? It's a lot of people like to talk about how competitive the Premiership is, and I'm not saying that isn't the case, but it does almost seem that Sarries in Exeter and maybe Wasps as well are going to be the top two and three, and Irish and Worcester are going to be cut off from the rest. And within the middle ground, it is going to be incredibly competitive, but it's not as competitive as a whole league as people would like to make out. But yes, Slade, it was a wonderful bit of skill, and it's the kind of thing that you hope to see when you watch him play.
Yeah, if Slade had arrived 10 years ago when England had no good centres, he'd have had 70 caps. I think it's just unfortunate that he's in an era when we're sort of blessed in the centre department, that he's only got a few sort of sub appearances and he's behind some very, very good players. But I expect again that he will be knocking on the door of being the utility back sub, or perhaps being in the squad for the Six Nations, definitely.
Yeah, and Simmons, he has looked incredibly exciting, hasn't he? It was a real breakout performance on the opening game of the season, and he just seems to be following it up. You know, they're not missing the Tanks tries at all at the moment, because he's got four now, I think, in three games.
Yep.
But one thing that I also find impressive is that he's clearly got strength, and you know, when he runs at people, you know about it. But he's got an athleticism that that Waldron doesn't have, and certainly if you're looking towards the future with England, I think he's got an athleticism that Billy doesn't have either. So you know, we'll have to see how he gets on, but I think there's some hugely promising signs for Simmons.
Yeah, and you were saying that it's, you know, you think that it's going to be Wasps, Sarries, Exeter at the top of the table. That is the top three of the table if you haven't seen it, so you know, some things don't change. But the idea that I think it's so competitive is this is the first time in three rounds that there's no one unbeaten. I think that's exceptional. It just shows that like you say, that middle bunch of teams can all beat each other. And there's like, I agree. I think those top three will go away, and then it's going to be an absolute dogfight for that fourth position, and then the other European positions.
It's going to be really exciting, and I'm looking forward to it. There's going to be so many close games. There'll no doubt be a few upsets, and there might not be huge upsets, but that's because there are a lot of close games, and it certainly is quite exciting.
Right, that was our very quick review of the games over the weekend. That's lasted about 40 minutes, but you know, we're cutting it down.
I've got one more for you, actually, Andy.
I'll go on.
I didn't want to steal your thunder, but seeing as you were going to throw out a stat about no one being unbeaten,
yeah.
Do you know that there was only one penalty missed the entire weekend?
That's obscene.
And it has happened before. I can't remember when. It's years ago, though. But only one penalty was missed the entire weekend.
That's a ridiculous stat. I'm trying to get my head that. Yeah, because the amount of penalties that normally take, and especially if, you know, towards the end of games, teams are trying to claw points back, they'll take them from perhaps more risky positions. But perhaps it goes to show that people are chasing bonus points. You know, they're kicking to the corner more. They're not taking on those kicks from the sort of halfway line, 10-meter line that might be risky. They're backing themselves to put it in the corner and go for the tries.
There you go.
All right. So to finish part one, we go with our regular feature now of try of the week, hit of the week, and then we're going to introduce a brand new feature after that. But Paddy, your try of the week, if you will.
So I want to give it to Raka from Clermont, but I can't. So I am going to choose Marlon Yard's try. Reasons being, not just because of Yard's finish, but I just thought the precision on Marcus Smith's kick for Mike Brown to be able to tap it back. And just given the whole situation of it being Marcus Smith, tough time, and to pull that off away at Wasps, and then just to be so pinpoint accurate, and then Brown to tap it back, and a wonderfully strong and powerful finish from Yard, that's the one that gets it from me this week.
Right, I've got four written down here on my shortlist for various different reasons, and I've been struggling to pick them. I've got my four on the shortlist with the Woodburn one from Slade's kick.
Yeah.
Maloof's finish for Leicester, just because I love the pass from George Ford. He was flat to the line and he misses all the players out to Vianu to make the break. It's beautiful. There was a nice one in the Sale game between Dally Solomona and Faf de Klerk where they almost did a sort of 1-2. Solomona picked it up, passed it out to him, and then de Klerk went and then passed it back inside to Solomona, and it just completely ruined the fringe defence. It was a lovely finish. And then my other one I liked was Charlie Walker's. I just loved the quick hands down the blind side from Quinns to get on the outside of Wasps. Marchant did a lovely little step, which brought Brown and which brought LaRue in, and then he could pass inside to Walker, and it was just nice hands. But just because I really, really like Henry Slade's chip, I'm going to give it to Woodburn. It was just so nicely executed over the top, easy catch for Whitten right into his hands, and then the give to Woodburn for the finish. That's going to be my try of the week.
And a fine try it was.
And if you do want to see that try by the Fijian guy for Clermont, say his name again for me.
Well, I believe it's Alvaretti Raka.
There you go, that guy. Do check our Twitter. We retweeted that one. And just if you want to see pace and stepping and ridiculousness, it's definitely well worth a look.
I believe it's his first start playing in the centres. So hopefully we'll get treated to a few more of those this season.
Right, and so second up is hit of the week. Who you got?
I didn't think, unlike last week, though, I didn't think there was a really obvious choice. And at one point, it was tempting just to say Sam Underhill, just for sheer volume, as opposed to a specific hit. But in the end, I settled on Timur on Trinder in the Leicester Gloucester game, and it was just the most forceful lined up hit for me, and I think given everything that's going on at Leicester, they needed something like that, and that was the most impressive hit for me, was Timur on Trinder.
Well, funny you should say that, because I've got three things written down for this. One of them is like you said, Underhill, just for pure volume. I had that exact one that you've just said, but I'll give it two. Now I've forgotten his how to say his name properly, but the big prop from Worcester. Now it wasn't necessarily a tackle as a hit, but he scored a try and he took the ball at such pace and he ran into like three or four Exeter players and just moved them all backwards and managed to score the try. I know you normally give hit of the week to a defensive tackle, but I just want to give special mention to him for being able to carry four men over the line with his big shoulder and a massive hit. And it was an absolutely wonderful piece of play.
It was. I think he's. Is it Allo?
Allo,
it's. But yeah, he's bloody enormous, isn't he? And yeah, we another try for him.
He's a hell of a unit, like you say. And hang on, I've got his name here. Yeah, B.I. Allo. Yeah. Right. So after hit of the week, we're going to start a new feature. This is what we're calling, because we're in the bin, and we're going to go for our bin juice. Bin juice is the stuff that's left at the bottom of the bin, the stuff that you really don't want to talk about, that's just disgusting. And I've got, like I say, a little list here. Number one for me are crowds at rugby in America. There was just disgusting to see the lack of people at that game.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Number two is South African rugby's performance this weekend in general. They got smashed by the All Blacks. They had like one man and his dog turn up to a game against in the Pro 12 where Leinster won against the Cheetahs, I think it was. No, against the Southern Kings, I apologise. And yeah, the attendance was awful. And I just think that there really needs to be... I mean, I know they're trying to grow the game out, that they've got real issues with the unions and everything, but something needs to be done about that. I just can't be doing with no people turning up to a club game like that. And my third addition for the bin juice is Blair Cowan, and we've already discussed that. There's just no need for what he did in the game.
Yeah, yeah, I think you've covered what I would consider the weekend's bin juice as well there, Andy. I think the key ones that I would pick out would be attendance, and that's to encompass the game in America, but also the one you mentioned when Leinster went out to, I think it's Port Elizabeth, which is quite a popular place for rugby in South Africa as well, I believe. But it is just no good, and it's embarrassing to see games that involve top class sides and you've just got this pathetic smattering of people in the crowd, and it's just horrible to look at. And a lot of this comes, as we say, it's not necessarily to do with the players in the rugby. It's decisions from people who aren't thinking about rugby. They're thinking about money and they're thinking about marketing, and I'm sick to death of it. And the other one that I would have picked up on the weekend is just the consistency of refereeing, as I said. And I really did get wound up by the praise for the refereeing Wasps Quins for dealing with players back chatting, because actually, not being funny, mate, but you brought it all upon yourself from being weak in the first place. That's my weak bin juice.
That was impressive ranting there. I'm proud of you. You're taking to it. It's my favourite thing to do after a weekend of rugby.
You know, I've always liked a good rant, and I'm generally just a miserable sod about most things. So I'm delighted to be able to actually have a reason to say it again at least once a week, where I won't get told off or moaned at by the wife or someone else.
Right, so we'll call that end of part one. We'll move on to the second part of the show now. And just before we do, a quick reminder to please check out lastwordonrugby.com. Excellent young writers on there, putting out a lot of good content, game reviews, good pieces of analysis on teams. Get down there, lots of stuff for you to read. We do implore you to do so. Now, we're going to start part two. I'll give you the choice. We can talk about the Pro 14 or we can talk about the Rugby Championship. What's your flavour?
I would plump for Rugby Championship.
Right, well then we've got to start with, I mean, I thought South Africa were doing, they were building quite nicely. I mean, they drew in Australia, they pumped the Wallabies, they beat Argentina both times, and that looked like a, you know, better result than it should have been when Argentina held New Zealand sort of quite close last week for quite a lot of the game. But there's just no living with New Zealand when they're in that form, and actually people are saying, oh look, it makes the Lions results really, really good. But I think you've got to remember that New Zealand have now played sort of six or seven or eight more games and are fully into being a squad for this season. And I think they'd have pumped the Lions at the weekend as well. That was just rugby on a different level.
Yeah, it's another one where you try and figure out, is this the All Blacks just being exceptionally good? Is it South Africa aren't as good as we hoped they might be again? You know, it's probably a combination of both. It's scary to think that the All Blacks at times in this Rugby Championship are essentially kind of leaving players out and trying new people with a view to the next World Cup. And you just wouldn't think it, because once they get going, it's just filth sometimes. Barrett and Milner Scudder try and the offload, it is just impossible to live with them when they play like that. But the thing that concerns me the most, and that I'm just not enjoying at the moment, is just the state of Australia and South Africa together. I mean, over the course of the last year or two, the results they've had just aren't befitting the rugby nations that we grew up knowing and expect them to be. And as much as, you know, I'm sure that both of us at times when we were younger just sick to death of the pair of them. But now they're just not that force, and they seem to be just on a real slippery slope, and there's not huge optimism for them turning it around quickly. It's just not very nice to look at and to watch, and you kind of miss them. You want these monsters of international and test rugby back, and that's the thing that's just kind of upsetting me a bit at the moment, to be honest.
I think there's two separate problems with them. I think South Africa's is the monetary issue, in that there just isn't the money in the country to pay to retain their best players, and so they all come north, and you can't blame them. It's a bit like the Islanders have been doing it for years. You know, when you can feed your entire village by playing in a different country, you go and do it. And these South Africans are getting picked up early, and they get paid to come and play away. And unless you're a top South African international, you know, your Eben Etzebethes or people like that, it's just not worth staying in South Africa, in which case they lose a lot of their talent. And I don't think the pool's as good, because it's still, I believe, up there. You know, there's this rugby, cricket, and I think football is quite big in South Africa now. But it's not like it's lower down their list of sports and they haven't got the talent. I just think it's being chronically mismanaged somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
Australia have the different problem. You know, the more TV money coming in, more sports getting more money, rugby's gone down, and rugby union has gone down and down the list in Australia under Aussie rules, under cricket, under rugby league, and under possibly football now as well. And they are not getting as talented a players through younger, because the players are more willing to go and risk it for an Aussie rules contract or an NRL contract. And therefore the young players coming through, I just don't think are as good. You know, you used to look at Aussie backlines and they'd have teams and teams of people waiting to come in. You know, when the Lions went there in 2001, they could play a club side, and the handling and the movement of the ball was like you wouldn't see in the Northern Hemisphere. But we've now stolen half their coaches. Our players come up in the back line, not quite to that level yet, and they've just not got the talent coming through. And I think it will only possibly continue to get worse for Australia unless they really look at some sort of talent identification.
Yeah, that is a huge problem. And the thing is, I don't think rugby union's ever been you know, one of their top three sports, for example. They've just always had incredible talent, and it's almost survived because of how successful and how good the Wallabies were. But then when you go through a prolonged period where they have no success and they're not able to challenge, they suffer so much more from a drop off in participation, and they just can't afford it because it isn't able to compete in terms of popularity and participation numbers with things like Aussie rules and rugby league and cricket. And it's hard to see how that's going to turn around, because it becomes a vicious cycle of, well, without some kind of success, how do you get it back? But without success, you've got fewer and fewer numbers year on year to be able to choose from, to actually then push into Australian rugby and get them to turn it around. And it is certainly pretty worrying.
Yeah, and I can't see a way out for them anytime soon. And I do want to give a special point to Argentina, who actually I really enjoy watching. I think their philosophy of trying to get the ball wide quite quickly, they've got some excellent back three players, and I do think they are developing better. I like the fact they've got South Africa and Australia to come to them next, and I really think they're going to be quite close games. If they can hold the Aussie backs, I thought their forwards did very well. And I just love watching Creevy as a player. He's just an animal. And him and Dane Coles, for me, are the best two hookers in the world. And they just play the game completely differently. And that's one of the things you can love about rugby, is that two people can play the same position in a completely different way, but do it fantastically well.
Yeah, Argentina, I really like. And they, you know, they're Italy's antichrist, really. You know, they had less time against, I think at the time you would probably say, tougher opposition when they joined the Rugby Championship. And the progression they've made, I think culminating really for me in the performances they had at the last World Cup and the win over Ireland, they were phenomenal to watch. And this wasn't countries like Ireland having, you know, a huge off game. Actually, they just couldn't live with Argentina on the day because they were too good. And I think that is just a monumental achievement in a relatively short space of time. And I'm always interested to watch an Argentina game. And I think there's definitely a lot more to come from. But they just seem to be doing everything the right way.
Yeah, I hope they get. I would quite like them to get the two home wins and really sort of balance out that championship. So it is. Everyone knows New Zealand are going to win it. They're not going to lose a game. It's just ridiculous. And then you've got the other three are actually quite closely matched, and it makes the rest of the games quite interesting. I'm actually more interested to watch Australia Argentina than I am to watch South Africa New Zealand, which says a lot about the way that the game's going. But I don't see why I'm going to turn on the telly and watch South Africa get pumped. It's not as interesting.
But I completely agree. I would be far more likely to watch a game between Argentina, Australia and South Africa. And then I'll just treat myself to watching the All Blacks highlights and see how good they were and the ridiculously good tries they run in. But I'll just watch that on the highlights. But if I want to watch a contest and an absorbing game, then I'll watch one between the other three.
Perfect. Right. So let's move on to Pro 12 and our first foray. Dipping our toes into the pools of the Pro 12 here.
Andy, I know the South African teams have been bad, but we are going to have to call it the Pro 14.
The Pro 14, sorry. it's even written on my sheet as 14, but you know,
Well, they haven't really turned up. So
they haven't really turned up. Yeah,
not blaming you, but yeah.
Well, the thing is, I've got the results in front of me and I've got the tables in front of me, and the tables are quite funny because the bottom teams are Zebra and the Southern Kings and the Cheetahs. And Treviso. So, you know, the two South Africans and the two Italy teams are at the bottom of their conferences already, which I think says a lot. And the top of the conferences are Munster and Glasgow and Leinster and Ulster. And again, just this pretty much the same as it was last year. The Scarlets are up there and so are Connacht. It's the same sort of five or six teams that I'm expecting to do well, are doing well. And I'm hoping that given another season and a chance to acclimatise, and they can get the talent back, the South African teams will contest well. But I think this is really just a trial year for them just to get used to the travel arrangements and the sort of competition layout.
Yeah, they've definitely got a bit of slack. I think the fact that they're essentially playing back-to-back seasons as well, you know, it's hard enough getting through, you know, one season without a break for modern day players. But to do back to back, I think it was always going to be incredibly tough for them. And yeah, they do just need to treat it as kind of a bedding in season. You know, it's going to be difficult working out the travel, although Leinster seem to be having far more problems than anyone else with figuring out the travel at the moment. But it's usual suspects, isn't it? You know, Munster and Glasgow at the top of one, Leinster and Ulster at the other, Scarlets are knocking about, Connacht are knocking about, Ospreys haven't maybe done as well as some people would have hoped, but then, you know, they have a tendency to do that, and we've got predictable teams at the bottom. Although, got to give a bit of a shout-out for Bellis and Treviso, who turned Edinburgh over.
I would love to have seen Richard Cockerell's post-match talk. Oh, I bet those players are wishing they had lost that game.
Definitely not.
I want to give a shout out to the Ulster Scarlets game, which were two teams playing rugby in an exceptionally good way. I really like the way the Scarlets play, and I hope that Gatland's watched that and has thought, right, I can get my Welsh team to play like that, because a Welsh team playing like that would be a fantastic thing to watch. But Ulster matched them and won it late, and I think there were four tries in that game, and all of them were very, very well executed. Lovely hands, nice breaks, and very, very good finishes. The quality of rugby was very, very high. And talking about people watching rugby in South Africa, anyone that went to Bloemfontein to watch the Cheetahs Zebra got treated to nearly 100 points worth of rugby, over 90 points, 54-39. I'm assuming that defence just wasn't the order of the day in that game.
No, and I think there was a lion's share of that came in the second half as well. I haven't really seen that much in terms of full 80 minutes from the Pro 14, because obviously I'm committed, Andy, and I've just been focusing on the Premiership. But there's games like that are just fun to watch, aren't they? And between two sides that are struggling, sometimes you often see these really bogged down, nervy, tense affairs, because everyone's so desperate to take advantage of the rare opportunity they have of looking for points. And then, as you say, to get almost 100 points, it certainly was a treat. And I just hope more people turned up to that than did to the Leinster game.
Right, let's leave the Pro 14 there for a week. And we're already pushing an hour on this edition of the In the Bin Rugby Pod. So we'll quickly go through next week's fixtures for you and make our selections. Starting on Friday night, a Gloucester home game. So surely a simple pick here when they take on Worcester at King's Home.
Yeah, I think particularly because it's Worcester, I think we're going to look at a Gloucester win, very possibly bonus point as well. It's just going to be, it's not going to be an easy afternoon or evening for Worcester at all. And they just haven't shown enough for me to think they can pick up anything at Kingsland.
No, I agree. I'm going to take Gloucester, possibly with a try bonus point. I think Worcester's main problem, as well as not picking up any points so far, is injuries are mounting. They lost Heathcote on Saturday, and I just think they will really, really struggle down at King's Home. Right, Saturday afternoon, Bath host Newcastle in what is going to be an exceptionally tasty game. Unfortunately, it's not on the telly, but I think that will be a great game to watch.
Yeah, it will, and it will be. I know that we quite rightly didn't discuss the Newcastle Saris game much because it was a bit rubbish, but there was still plenty of positive signs in that for Newcastle to show that they are not just going to be someone to be rolled over against anyone. I think the fact it's at the Rec and Bath are back there after losing to Northampton, I think they'll have too much, but I certainly don't expect it to be a runaway victory.
No, neither do I. I think that Bath pack will want another performance. They'll want to get back onto bullying forwards like they did before the Saints game. So it's going to be a big, big test of Newcastle's forwards, whether or not they can actually step it up and match it with one of the big boys after what happened against Saracens last week. But no, I agree. I think Bath will win. No try bonus point for Bath.
Might be a losing one for Newcastle.
Might be a losing one for Newcastle. Next game, the live game on the telly on Saturday afternoon is Quinns hosting Tigers, which is an interesting game for both. Quinns having won away from home, they need to now back it up. And Leicester having won at home now need to see if they can actually take their form away from home and see if they can again back up a win and not actually, because if they start the season with 3 defeats from 4 games, that'll be very, very bad start for Matt O'Connor.
It will, but I don't see it going any other way. I think Quinns will win, and I think that it will be comfortable. I don't think Leicester have enough to threaten Quinns, certainly not at the Stoop. I think even if this was at Welford Road after the away performance Quinns have put in, I'd tip him to win, but maybe in a closer game. I see bonus point for Quinns. I reckon they're going to win comfortably. I think it might actually be one of the most comfortable victories of the weekend.
That's brave. You are a braver man than me. Because I also just, and you know, like a cheeky stat, Quinns haven't won 3 games in a row in the Premiership since May 2014. So that's over 3 years. And having won their last two, that'd make a good start to the season and excellent consistency for them. I don't think it's going to be as easy as you say. I think if Quinns forwards can back up last week's performance, they're doing it off a shorter week, then they can definitely get the win. I'm not going for a bonus point. I think it'll be, these games are always tight and scrappy, and I think it'll be a win for Quinns, possibly a losing bonus point for Tigers. Right, and last game on Saturday, Saracens hosting the Sale Sharks.
Carnage.
Just carnage. Yeah, I think back at home, and they'll probably put another strong team out like they did in Philadelphia with the Vunipolas and Farrell and Liam Williams, who did have a very good game as well, are all back, and Sale do not travel well.
30-point winning margin plus, I reckon.
There you go. Do you know what? I can't argue with you. Yeah, I think it's going to be, it could almost be a repeat of what they did to Northampton at Twickenham. I think Sale just write it off. Steve Diamond just says, enjoy your weekend in London, boys. Go out, have a nice evening, and we'll see you on Monday, and we'll work to the weekend after.
Yeah, can't blame him for that.
Right, and then Sunday's, one of Sunday's games, like you say, Irish's first official home game of the season back at the Mad Stad, hosting the resurgent Northampton. I really hope Irish can put in a performance. I think Northampton are possibly one of the one team that they didn't want to have their first home game against. Now seeing Northampton's form, this could go badly if they don't start well, London Irish.
I think it could. I'm going to pick an Irish win anyway. I think that they're going to be bang up for this first, you know, proper home game of the season. They've had a couple of disappointing results and performances to some extent. And as good as Northampton have been, I still get the sense that there's either a bit of fragility about them, but also just with that attitude, you know, as good as they've been, it has still been a reaction. And I just sense that there's potentially a bit of complacency in them, or they're not always the most focused team. And I think Irish can really take advantage of that. And I'm going to go for a narrow Irish win.
I think Saints will win. And I think missing Blair Cowan for his idiotic, stupid behaviour last week is going to cost them, because they really need that full back row to function. That's what helped them really beat Quinns. And I think without him, they're going to struggle. I'm not sure whether Saints will get the bonus point, because I think Irish will be right up for it, like you say. But I think Saints will get the victory. And that leads us into the showpiece event of the weekend. Repeat of last year's grand final. Chiefs versus Wasps at Sandy Park. I think both teams look, like I say, without Ernie Cipriani missing for Wasps, I think Chiefs have got most of their big boys back now playing. I think it's going to be an excellent game. I'm not sure it's going to be a tri-fest, but I think it's going to be enthralling, and unless it rains horribly to ruin it, a great spectacle for the Premiership.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that it's going to be... I don't think it will be a runaway in terms of scoreline, but I don't necessarily think it's going to be as close a contest as the two teams might suggest. I think Exeter are gonna win without too much trouble. And the reason I say that is that they're the kind of team that Wasps won't be able to just butcher and bully through the back line, because they're too good for that. They're able to adapt their game to teams like Wasps, because as we've complimented them before, you know, they've got people with bits of magic like Slade and pace like Woodburn, but they can also really have a good power game up front. I think missing Cipriani is massive. I think they also do have more injuries, though, which is why I'm leaning towards it, because Reader's got, I think, have shoulder surgery, so he's missing. I think they're missing another back rower that went off. Who was, you're gonna have to help me out, who was the second one that went off?
It wasn't Sam Jones, was it?
It wasn't him.
It wasn't Young. Was it Thomas Young?
Do you know what? I can't remember, but it's not really the point. Just the fact that they've had two back rowers missing, Cipriani missing. They're going to Sandy Park against a team that don't have any obvious weaknesses or way to play around. And I just, for that reason, I think that Exeter are gonna win. And as I said, it's not going to be an easy game, but at the same time, I don't see it being a back and forth game or a Titanic tussle. I think Exeter are just going to win.
Guy Thompson got his name for you. Right. I think Exeter, they're not a misnomer, but I think they lost to Gloucester and then they've had the two easiest teams in the league. They've beaten Irish and they've beaten Worcester. So I think this will actually be a good test for them. I agree that Wasps have a few more injuries than I remembered. But with Gopeth coming in, I think that actually perhaps plays into Wasp's hands a little bit, because he won't necessarily run it as much. He will probably perhaps play a bit more territory, perhaps kick the corners more, put the pressure on Exeter more, which again will be better for Wasp, because I think trying to run it at Exeter is what they want sometimes. They'll happily soak you up and then they can hit you on the break. I do think Exeter will win, but I don't see Wasps rolling over. Not rolling over, you didn't say that, but you think that Exeter perhaps will make it a bit more comfortable than I do. I think Wasp will pull up a real fight. I think they've got a bit of dog in their forwards, in, you know, Cooper Woolley, Matt Mullen's a good player. The new second row, Rowlands, looks good. Nathan Hughes, they'll probably have Haskell starting. I think they'll definitely put up a big fight. And I wonder if they'll perhaps change their team around accordingly and perhaps not go with Daly in the centres, perhaps play the new South African guy, De Jonger. Keep Daly perhaps for a wing or fullback. Play Bassett on the wing instead of Watson and Wade. Again, a bit more power, a bit more size, and just try and not play the same all-court game that they would if they were at home, just to try and keep things tighter against a Chiefs team, like you say, that can play a number of ways and are quite comfortable in doing so.
For all the Rolls-Royce players that Wasps have, Gopeth is going to be pivotal to not necessarily the result, potentially the result, but also I just think the manner of the performance and how close the game is, a lot rests on Gopper's shoulders. But I also think Haskell will give away two or three penalties.
That's a given. Right. Yeah. So we've disagreed on a few of those, but that's our preview for week four of the Aviva Premiership season. That brings us to an end of episode four of the In The Bin Rugby podcast, brought to you by lastwordonrugby.com. Thank you for listening. Please make sure you subscribe to the Last Word on Rugby podcasts on iTunes. We're on there now for you, as well as listening on the website. And we will be back next week reviewing all those games we've just previewed. Thank you for listening. Say goodbye, Paddy.
Goodbye. And I will also just add that I'm doing nothing this weekend apart from watching rugby. So make sure that you check us out on Twitter at In The Bin Rugby, where I'll be voicing my opinions, whether you like them or not.
Like I say, thank you for listening and we will see you next week. Goodbye.
See ya.